Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Simone de Beauvoir.
French feminist.
Novelist.
Self-proclaimed midwife of Sartrean existentialism.
C'était contre toute oppression.
I was against any kind of oppression. The oppression of class, of individuals, of peoples. The oppression of individuals particularly.
De Beauvoir's monumental book, The Second Sex, is a classic of feminist philosophy.
I considered it to be an essay, a search to obtain a deeper knowledge of woman.
The first to distinguish biological sex from socially constructed gender.
When I began to write the book, I didn't even suspect how heavily woman's condition weighs on her. So writing my book was a revelation for me, an apprenticeship rather than a political act.
Our guest is Shannon Musset, editor of Beauvoir and Western Thought, From Plato to Butler.
The Philosophy of Simone de Beauvoir.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
We hope you enjoy this episode of Philosophy Talk.
Stay up to date with the program and receive our monthly e-newsletter by texting philosophy to 22828. That's 22828.
And to become a partner in our community of thinkers, visit philosophytalk.org.
Thanks for listening.
And thank you for thinking. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that start at Stanford University at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I are professors of philosophy.
Today, it's the legacy of Simone de Beauvoir.
Simone de Beauvoir is probably best known as a novelist and feminist thinker, but she was also an existentialist philosopher and, like her lover Sartre, thought a lot about freedom.
Now, John, I'm a big fan. I'm a growing fan in my old age of existentialist philosophy, and I've always been a fan of feminist thought. But, you know, I'm not really sure how feminism and existentialism go together.
Well, let's start with the more familiar part of Beauvoir's work, the feminist theory, and then see if we can work our way over to existentialism.
Okay, good plan. Her most famous work was The Second Sex. Now, that's a really big book, and it's a hugely influential book. It laid the groundwork for what's called the second wave of feminism.
Now, first wave feminism is a term we use for women's suffrage and property rights back in the 20s when they got the vote. The second wave broadened things to include sexuality, inequality, family, the workplace, reproductive rights, and so on. All of that started with Beauvoir's The Second Sex, and it continues.
Yeah, and in that book, she outlined powerfully how women are perceived as other in patriarchal society, other in the sense of secondary to the male, the second sex. Men, we're the first sex. We're the default sex.
She famously wrote, "One is not born, but rather becomes a woman."
Now, what do you think she means by that exactly, John?
Well, I think she's getting at how the roles we associate with women are not really given at birth just in virtue of biology. They're socially constructed, and women are taught that what they're supposed to be in life and what they're not supposed to be, what kind of roles they can or can't perform in virtue of being, quote, the second sex.
So let's try, and I think we can begin to relate that kind of idea to existentialist concerns with freedom and living in bad faith and all that, actually.
Well, do go on,
well,
Ken.
So look, existentialists are concerned with radical freedom, with the kind of freedom you have when you make a decision in good faith, when you kind of choose from the ground floor what you are to be. We always have that kind of radical freedom, Sartre says. And if you deny that, you're always free to choose yourself. You're living in bad faith. You're allowing yourselves to be ruled by identities imposed on you from outside. You can't do that.
Well, that's fine. But what does that have to do with this dictum that you're not born a woman, but you become a woman?
Well, think about it. If someone is taught her entire life that to be a woman, she has to behave in a certain way, dress in a certain way, play a subservient role within her family, work only certain kinds of jobs, have limited life expectations. And then if she accepts that role, she's less free. She's less authentic. She surrendered herself to the other, to the imposing other.
But look, existentialism posits radical freedom. You don't have a pre-established essence. And nobody else can decide what your essence is either. You always choose who you are. But then oppressive male society, it seems she's saying, preempts or co-opts the choice. It imposes an identity.
Yeah, you could wonder. You know, you're right. I see your point that you can wonder if that's consistent. Because if you're radically free, how's anybody going to impose an identity on you?
So maybe you're suggesting, Ken, that she shouldn't have written this 785-page, what she calls an essay, on male oppression. She should have said, hey, we're all existentialists. Buck it up, women. Nobody can impose your identity on you. You're condemned to be free.
Well, right. So that's a puzzling thing, you know. And help us get our way into de Beauvoir's mind. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to learn more about her life and her times. She files this report.
Simone de Beauvoir was born in 1908 to an upper-middle-class family, but that privilege largely dissipated after her grandfather went bankrupt. Beauvoir's father was determined that both she and her sister would get an education and become self-supporting.
And this was quite distinct, obviously, when compared to other bourgeois upbringings.
Bradley Stevens from the University of Bristol is an expert in French literature and history.
Women were expected to marry, to make a good marriage, and to go on and become good wives and mothers. Simone de Beauvoir, of course, didn't follow this path.
Beauvoir was one of the first women to get a degree from the Sorbonne. Later, as a young woman in the 1930s, she taught philosophy. And then in 1939, World War II hits Europe like a hammer. The Nazis occupy France.
More than three-fifths of their country was to be blacked out by a military occupation. The remainder was to be controlled by a French government acceptable to Hitler. A tax of 400 million francs a day was to be imposed on the French people to support the German army of occupation.
The war years are hard on Beauvoir, both personally and materially. Her apartment is so cold that she writes from cafes. Oh, and of course, the war separates Beauvoir from her lifelong companion, Jean-Paul Sartre, and her lover, Jacques-Laurent Bost. Both go off with the army.
And this separation from two very important men in her life left her at once vulnerable, but also acutely aware of her own independence and her own ideas.
Around this time, Beauvoir also begins an ill-fated love affair with a female ex-student that ends up bringing down her teaching career.
It's very easy with Simone de Beauvoir for us to focus on what has, over the years, been revealed to be an increasingly colorful personal life, her intimate relationships with both men and women.
But of course, Simone de Beauvoir should not simply be defined by her unconventional romantic liaisons.
Because she had a very rich social network that she helped shape and generate during this period. She was great friends, for example, with the artist Giacometti, and also with Cocteau, this very mythic, very irresistible image of a generation of great creativity.
Through it all, Beauvoir and Sartre were incredibly close. They weren't just partners. They read together, traveled together, and according to Beauvoir's autobiography, there was only one night in their decades-long relationship where they even disagreed. While Sartre was an existentialist philosopher, Beauvoir saw herself more as a writer.
This mantle of philosopher is one that comes loaded with a certain cultural capital, this image of a patriarchal, male, white class.
Beauvoir wrote novels and autobiographies so her thoughts would be more accessible to women of all classes. And then her book, The Second Sex, comes out. It's instantly popular and considered very scandalous.
Être femme, ce n'est pas une donnée naturelle.
Being a woman is not a natural fact. It's the result of a certain history. There's no biological or physiological or psychological destiny that defines a woman as such. She's the product of history, civilization, first of all, which has resulted in her current status.
Beauvoir's assertion that women can reclaim their social privilege and power and be equal to men rightly threatens the patriarchy.
And so you have Albert Camus saying to her in private, this essay makes French men look weak. You've got François Mauriac, the famous novelist, saying that this essay is borderline pornography. But the book sells 20,000 copies in the first week.
The Second Sex raised eyebrows, but it also cemented Simone de Beauvoir's status as a feminist philosopher. Beauvoir died in 1986. Her funeral was held 6 years to the day after Sartre's, and she was buried alongside him in Paris. Bradley Stevens says whenever he visits Beauvoir's grave, he sees flowers, metro tickets, cigarettes, and letters.
It's borderline mythic, and she would always warn us against the temptation to mythologize and idealize somebody's life or their reputation. Nonetheless, I think it's undeniable to say that Simone de Beauvoir is certainly one of the most important French writers of the 20th century. She is undeniably one of its great women.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for reminding us what interesting lives French philosophers have. You've got two sedate American philosophers here. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, the sedate Ken Taylor.
Today, we're thinking about Simone de Beauvoir. We're joined now by Shannon Musset. She's a professor of philosophy at Utah Valley University. She's co-editor of Beauvoir and Western Thought from Plato to Butler. Shannon, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Shannon, how did you first get interested in the philosophical work of Simone de Beauvoir?
Well, I would have to say that was just my feminism class in college. And like many other people, and probably like Beauvoir herself, I read The Second Sex, and suddenly a problem that I hadn't even realized was there appeared to me, and my whole world shifted.
Well, we mentioned earlier her provocative statement, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. I mean, what is Beauvoir saying here? What did it mean to you when you had this experience of reading her book?
Well, I think this idea that the masculine or the male is sort of the default in our culture and in our language is just something that you don't really see until you start to investigate it. And once you look at this idea that women are made, and they're made to sort of be the prop or the other to men, well, then suddenly you start to understand that it's a construction from the ground up.
But wouldn't that be true of any gender role? I mean, are men born rather than made? I mean, are parents born rather than, aren't all social roles made rather than just given by nature?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the best things about existentialism is the way that it makes us question any of these categories or what they might call absolutes and say, actually, these are artificial and we create these and we give them meaning. They don't come to us already endowed with meaning. But the question of woman seems to be a different kind of a construction because it's so difficult to see where it begins and to also understand how complicated it is. So if I want to question something like, well, what is the category of Republican or Democrat? It's easy to see how those are constructions. But woman is such a huge, enveloping question that it's a little bit different than the other kinds.
Well, but suppose someone were to say, look, isn't Beauvoir kind of overstating the case? Because, look, women are genetically and biologically do have certain roles to play. If we're going to have a human species that continues, women have to bear children.
I'm not sure that's so true anymore, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, well,
in 1949.
In 1949.
In 1949, absolutely.
As I remember 1949, that's the way we would have thought about it. And moreover, if you look at women compared to other species, these are kind of the roles that all the female of all the mammalian species play. So in what sense is it not largely biological that women's are kind of connected with being at home and raising children and nurturing things like that?
Well, so on the one hand, I think that one of the great things about something like The Second Sex is it really takes seriously biological and physiological and psychological forces that go up to make this category of woman. So, of course, these things play a role. But since it is from an existential perspective, it's also about the individual. And individuals are not captured by anything biological or physiological or psychological. We define those things in our acts. We're not defined by them before we act. And I think that allows us to sort of rupture this idea that women are destined to be mothers or wives or to stay in the home.
Well, that's interesting stuff, and I'm gonna follow up on that after the break because I think it kind of tiptoes us right up to a kind of paradox I have with the combination of feminism and existentialism. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Simone de Beauvoir with Shannon Musset from Utah Valley University.
In our next segment, we're going to kind of try to get deeper into the relationship between Beauvoir's feminist thought and her existentialist philosophy. How are the two connected or disconnected or what?
Gender, freedom, and existentialism. When Philosophy Talk continues.
That's all. Being a woman, made not born, says de Beauvoir. I'm John Perry. I'm a philosopher. That's P-H-I. Well, never mind. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about the French philosopher Simone de Beauvoir.
Our guest is the editor of Beauvoir and Western Thought from Plato to Butler, Shannon Musset. You can join Shannon for a live chat on our online community of thinkers this coming Friday, March 14th at 12 noon Pacific. Check it out at philosophytalk.org.
So, Shannon, I can understand how socially constructed identities and roles can people can try to impose them on you. And I can understand maybe a kind of bad consciousness that accepts those identities, that lives like the slave is required to live or something like that. But de Beauvoir is an existentialist, at least some existentialists. Her buddy Jean-Paul Sartre believed in radical freedom. So how can anybody ever succeed in imposing an identity on you if you're always free to just say, hey, no, dude, that's not what I choose to be? How can that work?
Well, one of the things that I love about Beauvoir is that I believe she really maintains that we are radically free, but she's also so deeply affected. And even before writing The Second Sex, even when she's working on The Ethics of Ambiguity, she's affected by this idea, but wait a second, not everyone is in the same situation. Can you really expect the woman in the harem or an American slave to see themselves as free when they have been told by nature, they have a certain essence, and it's to be secondary. It's to be the oppressed member of society. And so she's really taken by that exact question herself. And so she actually focuses on this notion of ambiguity, that it's not clear cut. We don't really know that we're free. We don't come into the world knowing this. There are a lot of forces that have to sort of come into play to allow this to become a realization that we can take full responsibility for.
So it sounds like you're saying de Beauvoir had a, I don't want to diss Sartre, she had a much more complicated view than Sartre, because maybe I misunderstand Sartre, but if Sartrean existentialism says I am radically free, right? And that means I can always kind of constitute myself, and not to realize that, he seems to think, is to live in bad faith. It sounds like you're saying that de Beauvoir doesn't think that's completely adequate to understanding the reality and possibility of oppression in the world. Is that a fair summary or not?
I think that is a fair summary. I think that Sartre's gift was this incredible, explosive idea of radical freedom, but he was also famous for saying that even the prisoner in chains is radically free. And on the one hand, that prisoner is. On the other hand, there are limiting factors that are preventing the expression of freedom that Beauvoir is very attuned to. She focuses on childhood, for example. She's very aware of the fact that children aren't considered radically free in the same way an adult is, and how a child is educated and socialized is going to contribute a great deal to how, when, and if they're going to be able to accept and enact this radical freedom. But it's always there. It's always there. It's just not always given the same kind of situation for expression.
So one of the people influenced by Sartre was Eric Fromm, who had this great book, Escape from Freedom. At least I thought it was great when I read it as an undergraduate. Maybe I should reread it. But the idea of escape from freedom was bad faith. Here you can be free. You should realize that. And then if you say, yeah, but I'm a CEO of a company, therefore I really have to be interested in maximizing profit for the stockholders, or I'm a philosophy professor, so I can't do this, I can't do that. That's escape from freedom. But that does seem to presuppose that you realize that you're, what you're escaping from. And if de Beauvoir, the way you describe it, seems to have a little bit more subtle approach to it. So that there's a precondition
Absolutely.
For bad faith, which is something she needs to spell out, I guess.
Right. Well, and so oppression is the very move that people make to prevent others from coming to an awareness that they are radically free. And it is possible to do. You can't eradicate the freedom of the other without killing them, but you can certainly prevent them from having the awareness of it to a real, to a very extreme degree. And so we have to be able to understand that not every person, not every individual is going to find themselves in the same situation. Now, however, once we do come to the awareness that we are radically free, then all of those bad faith rules apply. So, once I recognize my radical freedom, right, I can't use the CEO excuse or the philosophy professor excuse. I have to accept the fact that I am responsible.
So is this a fair summary? I'm just trying to get my grip around the. It's a complex set of ideas, right? But I'm just trying to get my head around this, the totality of idea. Well, a part of the totality of ideas. So the first thing that an oppressor has to do in order to oppress me is blind me to the real possibilities for myself. I mean, they have to interrupt my seeing of myself in a certain way. Because if I see
Absolutely. Sure, and institutions do this, individuals do this. I mean, it's not always fully intentional, but if I am educated and socialized in certain familial or educational systems, then I may be prevented from really having access to what I really am. And that's what's so terrifying to Beauvoir when she says, wow, it's not that women were not free, it's that they had been prevented for millennia in all these different cultures from coming to the awareness of it.
So
she thinks men and women are equal.
So I now make more sense of the idea that women, one is not born but becomes a woman, because in her sense of becoming a woman, at least especially this oppressed other, it's coming to see oneself or to fail to see oneself in a certain way because of the institutions around you that are trying to interrupt, you know, as it were, your self-seeing or something like that.
Exactly. I think that's a really good way of putting it.
So how much of Beauvoir's analysis of the problems of the second sex could apply to the first sex? I mean, over the last 20 years, we've seen emphasis on gay rights, which often means the freedom of males to not live within the sex roles that are kind of defined for them, transgender rights, so forth and so on. To what extent is the first sex also bound in a similar predicament?
Well, I think lots of people are caught in this kind of oppressive situation that she talks about. It's not just a problem that belongs to women. I think she discovers it when really looking at women. And I think now it's not quite the same. The rules aren't quite the same for what would constitute this category of the other. But I still think that that category is still a feminine category. And so people who get placed into that category, whether it be by virtue of class or race or orientation, are going to be placed in that feminized category of the other. So it's still useful to look at how she talks about it, even if you're not just talking about women. So then men, women, people of color, people of different classes can all sort of feel the effects of this analysis that she's talking about in the second sex without necessarily just being a biological female.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the legacy of Simone de Beauvoir with Shannon Musset, and we'd love to have you join this conversation. And Alicia from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alicia.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you for taking my call, and also I really appreciate your program. I came of age in the 60s, and even with the free speech movement, feminism was not really born yet, and I just want to acknowledge the fact that Beauvoir, unlike some of the other feminist writers, was really respected by the our better half, the men, who were, you know, kind of into the whole existential and Jean-Paul Sartre and all that, and that I actually, including my husband, saw men actually reading The Second Sex, which is pretty astounding, and I think that she really gave a certain legitimacy to the movement at its infancy in the 60s.
Thanks for the comment, Alicia. So, Shannon, so tell us about the actual on-the-ground influence, just expanding on Alicia's question, of Simone de Beauvoir.
Well, I think that was a great point that she made. Beauvoir did give a certain legitimacy because she was such a good philosopher. She was every bit the philosopher that Merleau-Ponty and Camus and Sartre were. So she was playing on that level. And therefore, when she wrote this book, people took it seriously. Whether they hated it or loved it, they took it very seriously. And so it gave a solid foundation to this burgeoning feminist movement. And I mean, if you want to talk about influence, if you read something like Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, which really launched that second wave of feminism in the United States, you see all sorts of elements of the second sex and Beauvoirian philosophy in there. This idea of the myth of femininity is very much, I think, influenced by what Beauvoir discovered in her own writings.
So during World War II, women were, at least in America, I'm sure it was true in Europe too, were forced out of their predetermined gender roles to do things like work in factories and so forth and so on. And then with the end of World War II, there was a movement to push them back in. That's the 50s. To what extent was this responsible for that being the time at which the second wave of feminism was launched?
That's a good question. I think that something that might have affected Beauvoir directly a little bit more during World War II was the Nazi occupation of Paris. And at that time, she really got to experience what it was like to need to rebel and to have to challenge a truly oppressive force in your own society and to see how oppression actually operated. And so I think that that really affected her as far as wanting to have a political and social stand against these kinds of practices and really infused a lot of her philosophy that came afterwards. And so I think that had a much more direct influence on her than the idea that women had to get out and work for the war effort.
I want to ask you another question, though. I want to go back to this self-seeing and the totally oppressed person whose self-seeing is interrupted. I mean, that seems to me really hard to do. I mean, even the kid who's not fully aware of his freedom chafes at his parents, you know, dictates and says, well, why do I have to stay out overnight? I mean, if freedom is ever present as a metaphysical reality, then why doesn't it shout to us? You know, in the moment of oppression, hey, what are you doing? You know,
does
she think it?
I think she does think it does. I think that if we were actually to go back and have some kind of magic way to reopen history, we would see people struggling against these oppressive structures all over the place. She saw this when she was working very closely with the efforts to stop the French-Algerian War, that people can be oppressed but be told that they are to be in this oppressed position by nature and forever, but they're still bucking up against it. They're still struggling against it. And so I think it is always there, but the idea is that it's constantly beating you down. The social forces are constantly telling you, no, 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 you don't have it. And after a point, people tend to sort of resign themselves to the given. They resign themselves to their situations and they stop fighting or they die trying.
Or is that resigning themselves? So I remember reading The Ethics of Ambiguity. Is that what it's called?
That's what it's called.
Yeah. She talks about resignation and she talks about complaint. And both are somehow expressions of freedom or something like that.
Right. I mean, that's something that I was exploring some years back, that when I was trying to tease out this idea of all of the different ways that one could still be radically free and yet not be taking full responsibility for that freedom, that there are different ways that freedom can expend itself, that one can resign oneself to one situation, one can revolt against it, one can fully accept it or just sort of have it dissipate because there's no active avenue for it to be taken up by. One of the great things about Beauvoir is that she recognizes that our freedom requires other people to take it up, take our projects up in their own projects. And if I don't have anyone taking my projects up, if I'm being told that they're useless or worthless or don't contribute anything, then I'm not really getting very far in the utilization or the expression of my freedom, even if I am free, right? It's kind of abstract and empty at that point, even if it is there.
We have some good email from our old friend Paul in San Francisco. Excellent conversation. If we are radically free, then by what standards do we evaluate our choices? And if we are radically free to choose our standards, then by what standards do we evaluate those choices? That is, isn't radical freedom kind of not give us much ground to stand on? It's just kind of this...
It gives us no ground to stand on.
Yeah, I mean, is that really a helpful perspective?
I mean, I think it's exhausting, actually. I think to fully live this sort of existential freedom is exhausting because you have to recognize that at every moment you're choosing yourself. But on a certain, in a certain level, if that's true, then why not accept that? And so there is no justification for my actions outside of my giving them meaning. But maybe that's just the way things are. And if I accept that fact that who I am and what I choose to do is validated only by those choices and by the way in which they go out to others and are accepted by others, well, maybe that's just a more true way to live.
So, you know, somebody would say, this is very Western, kind of a kind of radical autonomy, self-making and all that sort of stuff. I mean, but let's ask a kind of normative question. Suppose I lived in a society in which it was kind of the norm is to bow to the other, the parent, the social structures like Eastern societies, and the self is less kind of important.
Old people like me treated with tremendous respect.
What is the De Beauvoir Sartre existentialist complaint against that form of society? Is there some, or is it just this is how we do it in the West? We think about ourselves.
I think it is. It is a Western conception, I think there's no doubt. But if I wanted to sort of save it a little bit, I might say that there's still no ego or soul or substance there that's doing any of this stuff. So in a certain sense, I think that it could transcend different cultures. It's really just the activity of living. It's the activity of choosing, if you want to say what freedom is. There's no human nature there that's supporting it. It's just the very act of living itself. And so that act is going to be taken up in all sorts of different cultures in different ways. But I think somebody like Beauvoir would say it wouldn't matter if different cultures are educating people to behave in different ways. That activity of living is the same.
Well, I mean, it seemed to me when I used to read a lot of Sartre, and I must say, if you really like French philosophy of that period, it is a tremendous burden. I mean, their books are so long, but to me, Sartre was just this. It was like a natural extension of philosophy. I mean, you get into philosophy, you read Descartes, you start questioning. You get through the first meditation, you realize all the other meditations are just so much bull. And you know, it's very liberating. And then it's very liberating, and then it becomes very frightening. And Sartre, more than anyone else, kind of developed this, to me, idea, not so much what it is to be human, but what it is to be philosophical. Now, whether that's particularly Western, I don't know. I mean, Confucius didn't seem to draw the same conclusions, but maybe he did.
You got a brief response to that?
Well, I agree. Yeah, I would just say that I think that these books, The Second Sex and Being in Nothingness, they are monsters, but I think they capture the very passion of philosophical inquiry, unlike most other books written in the 20th century. So I think that they do carry on philosophical inquiry in a way that is deeply moving and very intoxicating.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Simone de Beauvoir with Shannon Musset, editor of Beauvoir and Western Thought from Plato to Butler.
What would Beauvoir think of the progress women have made or not made since she wrote The Second Sex 65 years ago or so? What would she say about the feminist cause now? And what do feminists today think about Beauvoir's ideas?
Feminism, then and now, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, I wouldn't want to argue with that point of view. Man smart, but women smarter. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking about the philosophy of Simone de Beauvoir. Our guest is Shannon Musset from Utah Valley University. And Shannon will be part of a live chat at our online community of thinkers this coming Friday, March 14th at 12 noon Pacific time. I hope you can join us at philosophytalk.org for our live chat.
So, Shannon, if she were alive today, what do you think Beauvoir would say about the progress of women? And in particular, in philosophy, there's been a lot of discontent because in philosophy, the number of women faculty lags behind a lot of other disciplines. And people are trying to figure out why that's so and what should be done about it. What advice do you think Simone de Beauvoir might give to the present generation of men and women philosophers about this problem in philosophy?
Well, first, I think she would be thrilled. I think she would say, as far as the progress that has happened since the writing of The Second Sex, she was politically active all the way up until her death in 1986, and she was really excited to see all these changes and all this political activism and women being exposed and invited and participating in avenues that they had never, that had been barred to them before. So I think overall, she would say, good things have happened and continue to happen. But I also think she would say, as far as whether or not the work has been done, is pay attention to history. One of the things that she was very good about, and if you read The Second Sex, you see how deeply immersed it is in the historical perspective, that we don't come onto the scene in a vacuum, that we don't exist in a vacuum. And if situations are such that there still aren't enough women participating in philosophy or other disciplines or politics or what have you, then go back and look at the history and see how we got to where we are so that you can understand why we are where we are.
You know, there's arisen in some circles a kind of de Beauvoir is very sensitive to history and the situation and all that, and that's deep and important. But there is a kind of line of thinking that's a cousin to hers that thinks, you know, all these ideas of autonomy and radical freedom are blind to the role of historicity and situatedness in constituting us. And many people think that, you know, this kind of radical autonomy is just a myth or something like that. I mean, does de Beauvoir ever confront that thought in directly and defend this view of hers against that kind of, you know, we're already situated. The situation plays a role in constituting us. Autonomy is a kind of, you know, there are lots of feminist philosophers, for example, who reject this ideal of a radical autonomy. So what would she say to people like that?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is simply in her works, where she shows all of the different ways that we are impacted and influenced by structures and power and things like that. And she would say, sure, I grant all of that to you. But when you ask for people to be liberated, when you fight against oppression, what are you appealing to, if not the fact that we are free and that we all have this ability to take responsibility for our actions and the creation of our societies? If you don't maintain that, then you're not fighting for anything. You're just part of the cog of a machine that has nothing to do with individuals.
So here's email from Lana in San Francisco with an interesting question. She says, third wave feminists critique the second wave for representing the concerns of white middle class women. Is this a fair critique of second wave feminism, and to what extent would it be a fair critique of Beauvoir?
It is a perfectly fair critique, and I think it's one that should be made and needs to be made, and it's a good one, because when Beauvoir talks about transcendence and what it means to be a human being and what the most fulfilling lives of human beings could possibly be, it sounds an awful lot like what an educated white male would find to be a very valuable kind of life. And it really doesn't take into consideration that maybe we ought to challenge the human as being very dominated by the masculine. And so I think that it's a completely fair critique. She was very sensitive to issues of race. She was very good friends with Richard Wright, and Nelson Algren had shown her around, and she toured the United States and saw all kinds of racial problems throughout the country. But she did tend to collapse the problems and say, wow, just like people like African Americans in the United States suffer, so do women suffer. They both get placed in this category of the other.
But she also had, I don't know if you would call her a Marxist. I guess not a Marxist, but she thought a lot about Marxist critiques of social life and history, didn't she? So that's not just from a white upper class perspective. I mean, that's solidarity with the proletariat.
Yeah, absolutely. She had solidarity all over the place. So she may not have been wise to the fact that her idea of freedom may have been biased by her education and class to the full extent that she could have. But she studied very much and believed very much in these kinds of social movements and class consciousness and, you know, racial and gender identities that we all sort of fall under. So she may not have been able to fully envision the third wave critique of her work, but I think that she at least had all of the ingredients to acknowledge the fact that, yeah, there were a lot of loopholes and blind spots that she would be more than happy to address.
Yeah, I get you. I don't really want to, I'm not an expert in this, so I don't really want to wade in too deep and defend it, but I don't see that it's a criticism of second wave feminism or de Beauvoir in particular, that some people are not in a social position to conceive of themselves as yet a subject of radical freedom. That shows you how diminished in some ways the socially given possibilities are. That shows you how oppressed they are. Now, you might say,
absolutely,
oh, who do you get off calling these people even more oppressed? But you know, oppression. Look, the slave who accepts his slavery and thinks that it's, you know, like God-given or something or irresistible, that's the most oppressed person imaginable.
Exactly. And you want to think that people can be liberated from those conditions because they are free, and that we can appeal to that because it doesn't have to be that way.
Let me try out an idea that's that's from a very different perspective, and I may want to disavow. But if you look at biology, if you look at mammals, what stands out about humans is not that women have some especially subservient role, but that men have been drawn in a very unusual way into what biologically is basically the woman's enterprise or the female's enterprise of having and raising children. So from this point of view, the problem with the human condition is that women have only halfway won the war. They've got men that are much more involved in a domestic and worthwhile pursuits than your average goat or bull, but they're still extremely weird organisms that do all kinds of strange things like start wars and beat people up. So the problem isn't really to make women have the freedom of men, but to get men more involved in the kind of gender roles that are typically associated with women. That's my analysis.
Yeah, and I think that she is sort of aware of that. She said, look, even if women work, and she's saying this in 1949, and it's still true today, even if women work, they are largely responsible for the domestic activities when they return from work. So they're either in the domestic space or largely required to look after the domestic space, and that still doesn't seem to be equal, and that still doesn't seem to allow for their transcendence or free activity in the same way that the masculine or men are allowed to experience that. So it's still sort of the same kind of problem. But again, this idea that even the domestic sphere or raising children and all that is women's work that men need to participate in, I think she was spot on about that. There's no reason why that's inherently women's work. That's been relegated to women, and therefore it's been diminished and put in a secondary category as less important. But there's no reason why participating in that is some kind of is being feminized in some way.
So, see, this is where, if we had more time, this is where I want to push back just a little. You say relegated to women, right? As if men handed it over. A species is a complex thing, and its species life is a complex thing. And through some interaction, some complicated dialectic, as it were, between men and women, it has come to be, it came to be the women's sphere. But I don't think it's just men just said unilaterally, oh, you guys, you occupy the domestic sphere. I don't know exactly how it happened in the prehistory of humanity, but I don't think it was just a relegation, a one-sided relegation.
And that's what's so great about Beauvoir. There is no beginning to any of this.
Right.
And so if you read something like The Second Sex, it's about 12 to 20 different perspectives, ranging from myth to history to psychoanalysis to Marxism, trying to figure out how this happened. Because you're right, there was no war. Women didn't lose this big battle to men, and men put them in this subservient position. It just sort of has always been this way, and there is no origin that we can point to. All we can do is talk about all of these different perspectives on how it could have come to be.
Well, Shannon, this is a fascinating conversation. I wish we had another hour because I think we're just penetrating down beneath the surface of this huge iceberg. But I have to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. It was pure pleasure.
Our guest has been Shannon Musset. She's a professor of philosophy at Utah Valley University, co-editor of Beauvoir and Western Thought from Plato to Butler. So, John, what are you thinking today? You had a complicated thought there at the end. I'd love to have time to explore it more sometime.
Well, my basic view on all these things is men are the problem. They're a very strange and anomalous being. They're not at all the norm. The norm is anyway, that's my view.
Yeah, you gotta
men are the problem. Boys are the solution. We got to acculturate them.
You got to read The Second Sex again, because de Beauvoir goes on and on about the weirdness of the human male as opposed to other males. Other males in other species, they after they help propagate, a lot of them are done and useless. So you're right about something. But this is a complicated stuff, and we're going to continue talking about this complicated stuff because this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner. You too can become a partner in that community by visiting our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
And in particular, listen up, March 14th, that's this coming Friday, 12 noon Pacific. Join us for the community of thinkers because you can have a live online chat with today's guest, Shannon Musset. And now a man for whom speed is a natural fact, Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, if I could reverse engineer my prepubescent sexuality, and someday technology will possess that useless ability, you'd find many vague fantasies about beatnik women. I knew beatnik women from cartoons and the Saturday Evening Post and The New Yorker, from Peter Gunn, from movies. Those free-love beatnik gals were made, not born, sullen yet sexy in their black berets, tights, and sweaters. They were a direct descendant of the French beatniks, with their existentialism and bearded boyfriends on the left bank, or whatever the hell bank it was, who were in turn descendants of Simone de Beauvoir and her godless boyfriend Jean-Paul Sartre, who were not married, yet they both had girlfriends. How did that work? I'm sure it was all complicated and angst-driven, but in the brief glimpses I got of them from Time or Life magazine, they were presented as merely French and naughty. They morphed into beatniks, and then all the beatniks morphed into energy Krebs, because that's how America rolls. I was supposed to be attracted to strippers and playmates in Marilyn Monroe, but I couldn't imagine a social situation where I would meet a playmate. Not sure if I knew Hugh Hefner and I was a pop singer, I could hang out at the mansion, but I was 12 years old and lived in North Dakota. There were strippers, yes, it was an oil town, and oil workers have been known to frequent stripping establishments. So you go to a bar and watch women take their clothes off and get drunk, and then you go home alone, or you go home still hammered and your wife yells at you. I didn't quite see what the point was. And even at 12, I could tell Marilyn Monroe had issues. Her death had a huge effect on me because it didn't seem like something that happened with sex pots or whatever it was she was supposed to be. She belonged to a slippery adult world full of Kennedys and cocktails and low-cut dresses and perfume and cigarettes. The beat girls are on the fringe of that world, reciting poetry in the coffee house or jazz club or some slumming ad man would go in a Doris Day movie. You'd spot beatniks in a Perry Mason or as part of a subplot in a gold medal paperback thriller. Sullen, skinny women who might accept my kisses if I lived in Greenwich Village and could sing a folk song. That was possible. I'd never be Bobby Darin or Rock Hudson, but I could be a troubled young man with a guitar. A beatnik girl might kiss me while she was thinking about something else. Marilyn Monroe might accept kisses, but she really wanted diamonds and validation. The stripper might accept my kisses, but will eventually marry an electrician in Vegas and get divorced. Their children will be troubled. On the other hand, the beatnik might accept my kisses, but she'll marry a shrink or a philosopher. Their children, too, will be troubled. All those media images of women show me a large, bitter world beyond my own small, troubled borders. Now Life is gone and Look is gone, Saturday Evening Post is gone, Nugget, Cavalier, Stag, Ms. Magazine is a shadow of its former self, beatniks are gone, hippies are gone, we still have strippers, but now they're ironic. The bourgeoisie clucked their tongues, and feminists clucked their tongues, and the media clucked their tongues, and Marilyn Monroe died young, and the Kennedys died young, and we've all been grown-ups for a long, long time. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking too.
The bourgeoisie this is, the bourgeoisie that. He's like a little child sometimes.